Dr. Seibel, your best resource for answers to all the questions you may have about your menopause experience. Dr. Maish Seibel is an international leader on women's health and menopause and is committed to supporting women in navigating the change for a healthy, vibrant life. He's editor of My Menopause magazine in the Apple newsstand and on Google Play, and founder of Menopause Breakthrough, a 5-week online course that helps women create their own personal menopause breakthrough action plan. He's the former director of Harvard Medical School's Beth Israel Hospital Division of Reproductive Medicine, director of the University of Massachusetts Medical School's Complicated Menopause Program, and author of The Estrogen Window, Rodale Press, April 2016. Each month, Dr. Seibel will answer questions submitted by his community, real questions from women and the men who love them about the challenges and the blessings of menopause. Welcome, Dr. Seibel.
Sherry, thank you so much, and thank all of you for joining me today at AskDrSeibel.com. And I want to also tell you that we're delighted that you're here. And if you or your friends would like to submit questions in the future, just tell them to go to AskDrSeibel, AskDrSeibel.com, and submit the questions. And then each month we have these calls, and I answer as many as I can to try and help you navigate the change and get the information that you need to live a healthy and vibrant life. So with that said, Sherry, let's jump in and try to answer the questions that are coming in. And what's the first one that we have for today?
Perfect. So our first question is from Michelle. She would like to know why she feels angry all the time and why it seems to be worse when she has hot flashes. She says she's already on antidepressants and it's really not seeming to help. What are your thoughts, Dr. Seibel?
Well, anytime someone feels angry all the time, we have to, you know, take a look and step back and wonder if this is something to do with her own internal feelings alone or if her environment is one that is unhealthy for her. So, of course, we have to begin at the beginning and look at the environment in which she is living and existing. So that's, of course, very important. But she gives us some very important information in this, and I'm feeling that maybe that this may be tied in to the changes that she's going through in terms of her life, because she's telling us it's worse when she has hot flashes, which lets us know that she's near menopause or in that window of time, and she's also saying that she's already on antidepressants and it doesn't seem to help. One of the important things to realize is that with feelings like anger, anxiety, depression, those are very core feelings that we all experience. And then what happens is if we get in situations where our normal coping mechanisms aren't working too well, like when we're sleep deprived or having hot flashes or we're going through those changes that are typical of menopause, sometimes it's pretty hard to just stay on an even keel for even the most stable of us. But if you are a person who has a pre-existing problem where anger has been an issue for a long time, where there's issues that have to do with depression and anxiety, and you're not just feeling a little bit of sadness that passes, but it's a little more persistent kind of sadness where the anxiety has gone from just a little bit of tenseness to really feeling like very tense, very anxious, it's affecting one's ability to function. If you already were having that, then even if it's been treated well with medications, this is one of the commonest things I get from patients is that I saw someone just yesterday who came in and said that her anxiety had been pretty well under control for the last numbers of years. She was taking some medications for it, but she was 52, and in the last couple of years, things have gotten progressively worse, and she's noticed her periods have gotten wider, and whenever it's about 2 weeks before her periods, and basically when she finds that she can correlate this with what is left of her menstrual cycle, she's even worse, and these things are really incapacitating for her. So realize that mental health issues that are challenges are going to amplify in many of the women as they go through menopause. and medications that formerly worked cease to be as effective. And this is a very, very common story. I mean, every person, of course, has their own unique issues, problems, and suffering that they have to endure. Every person is unique, but as a general statement, the majority of women going through this transitional time are going to feel this way. So the thing that I would suggest that she do is talk with her, both her mental health professional, and hopefully she does have someone in, that is supporting her in that, and her menopause expert that is supporting her in that. And it's good sometimes to have two sides of this coin, because it's really two parts of the same problem. The thing that is missing often is that the mental health professional and the menopause professional don't necessarily communicate with each other. So this is a very important part. It's got to be like a triangle where the three of you are in touch with each other, and you, of course, are the one that matters. And the other two need to get together so that they can be complementary to your needs and not one miss the boat or not realize the other one's moving and adjusting medications or activities and so forth. Another thing, speaking of activities that can be helpful, lifestyle things that can be very helpful, is limiting alcohol, avoiding caffeine and stimulant types of things. Getting plenty of sleep is going to make you feel much more rested. And eating a good, healthy diet is very effective as well. Getting rid of the sugars and the trans fats and so forth is going to stabilize your mood. The final ingredient in lifestyle is exercise, because in depression in particular, there are several studies now that show that if you are a person who is dealing with depression, and we're talking here about mild to moderate, if it's severe depression, this may not hold up. Medications are usually necessary there, but in mild to moderate depression, exercise really makes a huge difference. And here's the thing that's really important, that is, the exercise can be comparable to medications, but here's the interesting point about it, and that is, if you are a person with mild to moderate depression and exercise makes you feel better, which it will much of the time, the recurrence of the depression with exercise is actually much less than it is with the medications. And that's because if you know that what you do can make a difference and you have that control over it and you can make a difference, then it seems to act in our brains a very different way. And so you're not only going to get the benefit, but you're going to have a benefit that's more long range with less risk of depression recurring. So what I would say is make sure your environment is appropriate, safe, and compatible. Make sure that you have your mental health person and your menopause person talk to each other and try and get treatments that bring together what you need and alter your lifestyles. And I think you're going to find that all of this will get better. At least it's very likely that it will in the near term.
Very, very interesting, Dr. Seibel. So our next question is from Sean, and she would like to know, I know this comes up with a lot of women you talk to, she would like to know what she can do about the pain she's experiencing during sex and her lack of desire.
Well, Sean, you've addressed an issue that's a common one for literally millions of women, and that is my mojo is gone. And when I finally decide I can, or I'm in the mood, or I'm willing, it hurts like hell. Forgive the expression, but that's what I'm told. And I would rather be shopping than I would be having sex. And it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the partner. If it's painful, who is looking for it? How do you get into an amorous mood when you know the second of penetration, it's going to just be a painful experience? That is not an incentive for lovemaking. And so it's common, and the good news is it is fixable. So in terms of mood and the lack of desire, much of this has to do with hormonal changes that occur during the change. The most important hormone in this situation is estrogen, and many times a little bit of estrogen in terms of the brain and enjoying sex can go a very long way to making it better. For some women who have also got a low testosterone, then it is helpful to add testosterone. But for the majority of women, estrogen alone works, and testosterone is a secondary medication to consider if your own internal testosterone levels are low. Because think about it, if your testosterone levels are fine, giving you testosterone doesn't make any sense at all, even though people have been told by their girlfriends and by other people, oh, take testosterone. That's not necessarily the case. For the painful sex, there are a lot of reasons to look into what is causing the pain during intercourse. The most common reason has to do with the changes that occur in the vaginal tissues. As one woman told me, she said when she was young, her face was smooth and her vagina was wrinkled. And when she got old, her face was wrinkled and her vagina got smooth. And she really summed up exactly what goes on, because as estrogen goes away, the wrinkles in the vagina allow it to distend. That's how it can hold a penis in place and be firm in holding it, and at the same time allow a baby to pass through. So it's clear that the vagina has distensibility, like the sleeves of your socks or of your jacket, that are elastic and can expand and come back in size. And when those sleeves, those little corrugated folds, go away and flatten, the tissue is now a rigid tissue and it can't spread or separate or expand. And so the penis goes in, and what ends up happening is it's painful. And also the tissues are thinner because they don't have the blood flow, and it's painful. And so the most common and effective thing for that is topical estrogen. And so you can use that as a very helpful tool. It can be applied as a cream. It can be applied as a pill. They have pills that can be placed into the vagina that release the estrogen. But it's a very helpful thing. And usually if you use it for about use it regularly for about 2 weeks or so, it gets a lot better. And if you then use it a little less often, it'll maintain it out a bit. There's also a new medication that's out that's just been approved in the last year or so that is a non-estrogen called Osfina. It's a medicine that is used sometimes for women who are dealing with cancer, the most common one being breast cancer, but for other cancers, it's actually a selective estrogen receptor modulator, ospemifene. It's a fancy word for a type of estrogen that works on the vagina positively, but doesn't have a negative effect on the breast. And finally, there are certainly some great over-the-counter materials or products that are out. An example might be Replenz. It's a moisturizer that can be put in over the counter. And, of course, good old organic vegetable oil can be used that you buy at one of your natural food stores, and that can be used by some women effectively. And I would say that if you're interested, since you're on this call, we have a Better Sex, Better Intimacy program. It's a 6 audio file program that goes into great depth about this issue. It talks about the when do you need a counselor. It talks about issues that have to do with intimacy when you have cancer. It has a whole lot of material and a lot of tips and information from 6 interviews that I do with some of the country's very top experts. Normally, that program is $197, but if you go to BetterSexBetterIntimacy.com, that's BetterSexBetterIntimacy.com, and add the code GETANSWERS. Use that code, GETANSWERS, And you will save $100 on that. So it'll be a $97 purchase, which is a great savings. And you'll get the benefit of almost six hours of discussions on all these different topics that I think will serve you very well.
Oh, that's awesome. And those interviews are just packed with information. So I hope everybody will check that out at bettersexbetterintimacy.com. Awesome. So our next question is from Joanne. And she says that she's had a hysterectomy, and she's wondering how that will impact her menopause experience.
Well, hysterectomy is a pretty common operation in this window of time, Joanne. And I will tell you that roughly about 600,000 of your sisters every year are having this operation. So the question is, of course, did the hysterectomy come and then cause menopause, or were you in menopause and then have the hysterectomy? And that's a little bit different story. But let's begin with the first one. If you have a hysterectomy and you have your uterus removed and your ovaries are left in, that will stop your periods, but it will not put you in menopause at that time. However, about 70% of women will go into menopause within about 3 years of a hysterectomy because it affects the blood flow to the ovaries, which are left behind, and that will put you into menopause maybe a little earlier than you might have, maybe not, depends on the individual, but about 70% of the time menopause will follow in about 3 years. Now, if you have your uterus out and you have your ovaries out, no matter where you are in your reproductive years, you're in menopause at the end of that operation, and that's called a hysterectomy and bilateral salpingo oophorectomy. Salpingo is the tubes, the salpinks, and the ovaries is the oophorectomy, removing the ovaries. So that will throw you into menopause. The if you're already in menopause and you have your uterus removed, then the issue has to do with the type of hysterectomy you had. It gets a little bit technical, but let me just say that in an overarching way, hysterectomy will have very little impact on menopause for the majority of women. The thing is, your partner won't be able to feel anything different. The sense of orgasm and so forth still comes, although for some women, orgasm includes some cramping of the uterus. So there may be a change in the quality of orgasm, but it doesn't actually change the ability to have orgasm. The next thing is that why your hysterectomy was done makes a difference. In a study that I did a number of years ago in women with a hysterectomy, and it looked at its impact on sex, what I found was, is the more clear the woman was about the cause of the problem and that she was actually getting a benefit to her health, the more she understood that her procedure was necessary and indicated, the better she did sexually afterwards. If she felt it was done and she wasn't really clear why and it wasn't sure if it was necessary, that can wreak havoc because then there's a loss. But losing something bad is a gain. And I hope that makes sense. So the fact of the matter is that the more clear you are, if you have to have a hysterectomy, understand the reason and the benefit to you, and it will help the overall impact. The one thing that hysterectomy can change, depending on how it's done, is that the ligaments that hold the uterus up and inside the pelvis are also part of what holds the vagina and the bladder up. And so for some women who have a hysterectomy, they're going to be a little bit more susceptible to what they call the vagina or the bladder dropping. And so that's the bladder dropping is a cystocele, because cyst is what the name of the bladder is, or the vagina dropping. So those are a little bit more of a possibility, but certainly not something that's a guarantee to happen. It doesn't happen, but you're asking what are the ways it could impact you, and so I'm trying to answer you completely. So have a talk with your surgeon before. Some people, for preventing that, are doing something called a supra cervical hysterectomy. That's a hysterectomy in which the top part of the uterus, the fundus, is removed. It's like if it was a light bulb and the light bulb has that little screw part in the bottom, that's the cervix. That's the opening where they do the pap smear. And the part that expands where the light actually comes out, that's the fundus or the top of the uterus. So they just take that top part off and leave the bottom in. And the reason is that keeps all the support structures in place. Now, if you're having your hysterectomy done because you have an abnormal pap smear or something wrong with the cervix, the neck of the womb or the lower part, that, of course, can't happen. That's the reason you're having the procedure. And you can't take out the bottom and leave the top end. It's nothing to connect to. So talk to your doctor. Understand the reasons, the importance of it. Talk about the possibility if a supra, meaning above cervical, above the cervix hysterectomy, makes sense for you or not. And then at the end of that, I think you'll find that for the most part, you're going to realize that you're better off because you have the issue you were having surgery for taken care of, and you're going to have a very smooth sail beyond.
Awesome. So Jean has an interesting question. She says she's just started taking a medication called Brizdel, and she's wondering if it's safe. She says she really hopes that you're going to say yes because it's working really well for her.
Well, Jean, the first thing is I'm thrilled that Brizdel's working for you. It's great. It's a new medication that has come out only in the last, it came out in 2014. And Brizdel is a medication that's used a lot for hot flashes. Now, Brizdel is a medicine that is a low dose of like the antidepressant, the SSRI, paroxetine. It's a medicine that is a different form. It's a different salt form. It's a different molecule, but it's basically the same medication. And it's also in a lower dose than the antidepressant dosages of that medicine. So it is an FDA-approved medicine. It is one that has been taken in clinical trials safely for women. There can be some mild headaches or there can be some mild nausea, and there are some potential side effects. But the good thing is after about 3 months, most of the women afterwards are feeling, you know, not having those issues. And it has some sleep-inducing benefits. So at bedtime, if you take it at that nighttime dose as opposed to once a day in the morning, then the sleepiness can actually be a benefit. As far as safety, it meets with the FDA's approval for accepted rare side effects or complications. The things I've talked about are side effects. They're annoying, but they, as I mentioned, typically go away, but they're not complications. So I think you've picked a good one. And who uses this sometimes are women with, for instance, breast cancer, where they're not able to take an estrogen or don't feel the risk is worth the benefit, so that this can be used compatibly in that setting because it's a non-estrogen choice. So congratulations, you've come up with a good solution for yourself. You and your doctor have done that, and I think it should be a great fit, and hopefully it'll just keep working, and that's basically the story on Brizdel.
Oh, that's great. I love to hear it when they're coming out with new things that are really working well for people. So
yes,
the last question for you, go ahead, Dr. Seibel.
No, I'm saying that I was going to say in 2014 there were actually three medicines that came out that were FDA approved, and before that there hadn't been a medicine for women and benefits approved by the FDA in years and years and years. So it was a big year, and I'm glad these new things are out there.
Oh, that's awesome. So our last question for today is from Sandra. And she says, I've heard that hormone replacement therapy can cause breast cancer. Is that true?
Sandra, you're asking a question that has been an incredibly complicated answer to it, and one that is a question that's worried women for decades. And the short story is that hormone replacement therapy has been used for women to help them with a variety of symptoms of menopause since 1942, when it first got approved. The first one that got approved was Premarin. And without making this a very long story, I will just say that the thing that about this is the subject of my new book, The Estrogen Window, and it's from Rodale Press in April of 2016. If estrogen is taken close to the time of menopause, then estrogen can actually lower the risk of breast cancer. It can lower it by as much as 23%. So if women start their hormones, their estrogen, within the very narrow window of time after the onset of menopause, then they are going to benefit from it with a minimal risk of breast cancer, and what the newest studies show is actually a reduction. However, if you wait until 10 or more years, particularly if you're after the age of 65 when you start hormone replacement therapy, then you may then, in fact, increase the risk slightly. So the trick is to start it as close as you can to the time of menopause. Now, there's just been a new report come out, an opinion piece from the North American Menopause Society, that states that even in women over 65, if they don't have an absolute reason they shouldn't take it, and they take the lowest dose for the shortest amount of time necessary, they feel that it's still an appropriate treatment for women even beyond 65. So this is all good news. The trick is that you have to have your own personal history in mind. You have to have your family history in mind. And just work with your doctor to go on the lowest dose possible for the shortest amount of time. Now, if you want to know a lot more about this, the timing of hormones and so forth, in the meantime, you can go to a free training that I have. It's called menopausebreakthrough.com, menopausebreakthrough.com, all one word. And if you go there, you'll hear a whole story about the estrogen window. You'll hear about the ways that estrogen can be taken in order to lower your risk, not only of breast cancer, but dementia and heart disease. And you'll also learn a approach to the window of menopause and how to really have a very vibrant life in this window. And like, there's five steps that I outline for you in that training. And it's called, again, menopausebreakthrough.com. And check it out. And you can just register for it and listen at your convenience. I think you'll find it very helpful.
That is awesome. Well, we've had some great questions today, and I've learned a lot, and I know everybody on the call has. Any parting thoughts, Dr. Mesh?
I just want to thank you, Sherry, and I want to thank all of you for listening. I want to remind you that this is AskDrSeibel.com, AskDrSeibel.com. I invite you to ask your friends to join if they have questions. I'm happy. This is open to everyone. We take the questions, we read all of them, and we answer as many as we can each month at our monthly calls, and we are setting it up so that these calls will be available afterwards as a file that people can go back to. So again, thank you very much for joining us. Go to AskDrSeibel.com to submit questions. And thank you very much.
Perfect. Well, watch for us on future calls. We're always here at 6 p.m. Pacific time, 9 p.m. Eastern time on the third Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. And thank you again, Dr. Seibel.
Thank you, Sherry.
Okay, have a good day, everyone.